not really a change. Well, yeah, the reason I changed the subject is because I was in Buenos Aires during Christmas having fun till 3 a.m. every day, and I kept receiving mails from SBI telling me that, you know, different people were trying to change the subject. So at the end, I decided to accommodate or coordinate the best way possible, especially with Michael. And so I end up talking about selective topics in Higgs and supersymmetry. Okay, so what I will do is I will start with a very brief introduction for this well-trained audience with the motivations for having supersymmetry at the TV scale. And talking very brief, there are some SUSY scenarios and signatures. Then I will concentrate what I think was not done so far, saying a bit about the role of the Tevatron in shaping the next decade, especially vis-a-vis supersymmetry, the possibility for discovering new particles, and some cute idea, some cute example of indirect SUSY signatures. And the second part of the talk, I will move into the MSSM Higgs boson phenomenology. I will remind you some things about relativity corrections to masses and couplings, which turn out to be essential when we want to think about benchmark scenarios and Higgs opportunities, especially at the LHC. And finally, I would like to make emphasis on the effects of explicit CP violation in the Higgs sector, and especially how this can affect Higgs searches at colliders. Okay, so we all know that the standard model works great up to energies of 100 GeV without maybe a few question marks that we heard from Guido and Bill in their talks of, you know, sine squared theta W from the forward Baccarat symmetry, and also the value from W being a bit too high, and then this nice or interesting signal from a discrepancy with the standard model from G mu minus 2. However, there are many open questions, and we hope to give an answer to them partially in this and next decade. The origin of electroweak baryogenesis is our big question there. The generation of stabilization of hierarchies, the connection of electroweak and strong interactions with gravity, the generation of fermion masses and mixings, and the explanation of baryon asymmetry of the universe. I will especially say a few words about these, and dark matter and dark energy. And I think really that we all agree, hopefully in this audience, that collider experiments, namely the Tevatron, the LHC, and hopefully a lepton collider in the TV reach in the next decade, starting in the next decade, are our most robust handle to reveal the new physics that should answer these questions. And so I guess that's what we are having this workshop originally. Okay, so we know that electroweak symmetry breaking occurs at the TV scale. That's a proven fact. So in absence of big fine-tuning of scales, we expect that new phenomena should lie in the TV range or below, and this is within the reach of LHC and a prospective linear collider. We all know that there are numerous theories that have been proposed for that, mainly two big models, weakly coupled dynamics, and the standard model is the best known example of that, where the Higgs boson is posited to take care of electroweak symmetry breakdown. The Higgs boson has not been seen yet, and from all what we know from precision data, we expect it to be not too far away if we think about the standard model. However, in the weakly coupled approach, the standard model is most probably embedded in a supersymmetric theory, and this is what I will concentrate in the rest of my talk. However, there are other options like extra dimensions, and we'll have Joe Lickenstock for that. And then our strongly coupled dynamics with or without a fundamental Higgs as main component, and also recent models with you know, extra symmetries. And I suppose Nima will talk about that or something of that sort in the, some talk after me. Okay, so supersymmetry. Okay, we know that supersymmetry must be broken in the ground state, that's for sure. So, however, if supersymmetry exists, many of its most important motivations demands some supersymmetry particles at the TV range or below. And so let me remind you which are these situations and what we get from that, because I think it's interesting to to go through it. So of course, well, the first thing we all know is that supersymmetry proposes a solution to the hierarchy naturalness problem. And the way it does is that in low energy supersymmetry, the quadratic sensitivity to the effective scale at which the standard model breaks down is now replaced by the quadratic sensitivity to the supersymmetric breaking scale. And we need these SUSY masses to be of the order of the TV if we think that this is a good way of solving or proposing a solution to the problem. More in that direction, electroweak symmetry breaking is radiatively generated. And what this means is that if we look at the evolution of masses in supersymmetry as a function of the energy scale, what happens is that in the evolution of the masses from high scale to low scales, there is a negative Higgs mass parameter. Okay, this in this case is low tangent beta, so it's M2 only instead of M2 and M1, which is induced via radiative corrections. And these relative corrections are of course negative then, and the important contribution comes basically from stops and had to do with the important effects of the top Yukawa. And in order for that to be effective, we also need the stops to be somewhere at the SUSY, at the TV scale. So if SUSY breaking scale must be at or below 1 TV if we think that supersymmetry is associated with the scale of electroweak symmetry breaking. We all know that supersymmetry plays a central role in the unification of gauge couplings, and much work has been done in this direction, and you have seen this plot thousands of times, I'm sure, but what I just want to remind you is that this is really, although one can think that could be, you know, corrections coming from higher operators at the scale of unification, this is really a remarkable agreement between theory and experiment, and you know, the experimental value at the moment is what I wrote up there, and the prediction within supersymmetry for if we post unification for the value of alpha 3 at MC is what I wrote there. Okay, this is just the uncertainty due where we are placing the SUSY breaking the SUSY masses. Okay, but this is a remarkable agreement, which is of course impossible in the standard model because you know if sine squared theta W would be just 10% away from its mean value, so to say, this unification would be totally screw up. Okay, it would be impossible. So, Another interesting feature is that within supersymmetry, and I think it is interesting because we saw this behavior before, far before the top quark mass was discovered, so it's not that we were induced. I mean, we predicted that in some way, I think, within supersymmetric theories, that because of the large value of M top can be understood as a result from a quasi-inflexis point of the top Higgs-Yukawa coupling of the Yukawa coupling, and this has basically just you know fixing the experimental value of MB and alpha s. And thinking that we have some degree of unification between bottom and tau, and when I say some degree, can be away in like 25%, which is what we naturally will think in unified theories, not needs to be exactly unified, but also not so far away. So if we play with this relation, then this, of course, varies the prediction of the top Yukawa coupling at the low value. And within supersymmetry, we can compute the value of the top quark mass, and it's given by this expression here, okay? And as a function of tangent beta and the top mass, we see which is the behavior. So we see that although there is some spreading depending on unification and some dependence with tangent beta, for values of tangent beta prefer after left delta in most scenarios, we see that we can you know, predict a top quark mass more or less in the value that we see it. So of course, it also provides a good dark matter candidate, and WMAP has confirmed with great accuracy the cold dark matter density of the universe within that range, and within supersymmetry, you know, the most likely candidate is a lightest neutralino, and it's interesting to see that you know. Bill Marciano was mentioning that yesterday, that if we take seriously the 2.7 or so sigma deviation from G mu minus 2 seen at present, and we fold it, for example, in this case of a minimal supergravity scenario, this will actually, this is just different values of tangent beta that are compatible with the SUSY dark matter, the cold dark matter density that I wrote there. if we do so, and then we impose the G minus 2 constraint, so to say, or we want to account for the discrepancy from supersymmetric contributions, then this green area is excluded. And what we see here is that the neutralino, which is 0.4 times m1/2, is supposed to be then below 500 GeV, which then would be at the reach of the linear of colliders. Finally, I think that supersymmetry provides a very elegant solution to the observed baryon asymmetry of the universe, which is baryogenesis at the electroweak scale. In fact, if we consider that, you know, originally we have V minus L equals zero, well, at very high energy scales, baryon number violation is highly unsuppressed. And therefore, whatever baryon number will generate will wash out. However, below the electroweak phase transition, baryon number violating processes are very much suppressed. So if we are able to generate some baryon number violating process exactly by some non-equilibrium processes at the electroweak phase transition, it will be frozen after the electroweak phase transition occurs. And this is the idea of electroweak baryogenesis. So they are the non-equilibrium processes are basically generated together with some CP violating currents and extra CP violating sources, which what create is a chiral baryon antibaryon asymmetry in the symmetric phase. And then what happens is that net baryon number diffuse into the broken phase. And if we have a sufficiently strong first order phase transition, then baryon number violating processes are out of equilibrium in that broken phase. So we have to imagine that, you know, the universe is expanding and we have a bubble of broken phase expanding. And so some of the baryon number percolates to the other side of the wall and then it stays trapped there. Okay, and the idea is that if the phase transition is sufficiently first order, then we can preserve the baryon number which has percolated during the electroweak process, phase transition process. This is a very cute idea, and it was, of course, first tried very hard in the standard model. However, electroweak baryogenesis, this is strong first order phase transition, demands that the Higgs in the standard model has to be below 40 GeV, which is experimentally ruled out. And independent of that, within the standard model, the CP violation that we have in the standard model is not enough to generate sufficient baryon asymmetry. With seen supersymmetry, actually, both problems are solved. There are new bosonic degrees of freedom, mainly the stops that couple with order one couples to the Higgs. And so they are able to generate a sufficiently strong first order phase transition, which is compatible with a Higgs mass up to values of 120 GeV. Of course, this put a bounds on the stops as well as on the Higgs, and I will mention that in a second. Okay. Most interesting, they are in supersymmetry, there are new sources of CP violation from this fermion sector. This is, of course, the key ingredient to have some Charcino currents, CP violating currents. And what I have drawn in this picture is basically the baryon asymmetry to the entropy ratio, in the SUSY model that I'm looking at with respect to the one computed. Computed or predicted from Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And we see here that, okay, in this plot is as a function of the parameter mu of the Charcino mass parameter. And we have assumed that the phase for mu is maximal, so we have assumed that the sign of mu, phi mu, is 1, which means that that's why we get, you know, these values that are of order 10 or so. But of course, this means that if we would, this is done for 6 times 10 to the minus 11. If we would take 3 times 10 to the minus 11, we'll have a 20, actually, in this peak. And this means that once you fold in what is the phase of mu, that values of sine of phi mu larger than 0.05 are preferred if you want to have electroweak baryogenesis. And this is a very interesting, I will come back to this, okay? Okay, so I will go fast through this part because it's very basic. So we don't know the mechanism of supersymmetry breaking, and all what we know is that different mechanisms will give us very different patterns of low energy, so many different production and decays, so we have to be very alert because they can be very different the way we can C-supersymmetry at colliders. The most popular ones are basically what we call Sugre scenarios, and one of the key issues there is that we have the strong interacting particles that tend to behave than the weak interacting particles. That's a generic feature. If we have the symmetry R parity, under which supersymmetric particles are odd, then if R parity is conserved, the lightest supersymmetric particle will decay to anything, so it's stable, and this means that we have loss of missing energy, and this is a distinctive signature of these scenarios and detectors. As I mentioned before, the light supersymmetric particle being stable, in particular neutralinos, are a great dark matter candidate, although, in fact, in order to have the right dark matter abundance, most probably you have you're in a region where you have Stau co-annihilation, so the Staus and the neutralinos are very close to each other. What about the extensions of Sugre? I was trying to convince you that CP violation is a crucial ingredient in the MSSM if we want to think about electroweak biogenesis, and indeed, you know, most of SUSY breaking parameters may be complex. And what happens is that if you look at some U1 low global symmetries of the model, you can rotate away many of these phases into redefinitions of fields, but at least two phases you cannot rotate away. I mean, there could be more depending, you know, for example, if you have different phases for all the trilinear parameters of the fermion sector, for example. But at least two will be there. So in the minimal extension of M. Sugre, you put a phase on the Higgs mass parameter and a phase on the trilinear coupling. Of course, as you have heard from other talks, and having CP violating effects can pose, you know, important constraints on these parameters if we consider electrodipole moments of the electrons and of the neutron. And what I wrote here is the one-loop contribution of this SUSY, which is proportional to the imaginary part of mu times the imaginary part of A. Okay, and then these are the fermion masses that enter in the loop, and these are the Gaussino-Higgsino masses that enter in the loop. So the one loop, you will be one fermion and one Gaussino contributing to the EVM. So it's easy to solve this one-loop crisis, so to say. So either you have phases too small, and then you can have SUSY particles very light, at least the first, I'm talking about the electron and the first two generations, the first generation of squarks. But of course, this would not be our preferred scenario if you want to have electroweak barogenesis. That won't work, okay? So the other option is an easy option. It's just we need these squarks and fermions to be of the order of 2 TV. So the first generation squarks and sleptons to be of the order of 1 TV. If not, we can invoke some cancellations between EVM. And it's interesting to know when you go to loop to loop contributions, and actually higher order, there's very nice work by Pilatsis, recent work of Pilatsis in this direction, that you get much bigger constraints, and now the constraints touch the third generation squarks, especially for large function beta, which are important for our ideas of electroweak biogenesis and for the Higgs sector. However, this makes really much more challenging to reconstruct SUSY masses and couplings for experimental data. This also constrains much more which are the possibilities for CP violation that you have within the MSSM, but still things work fine if you look in the proper region of parameter space. Well, gauge-mediated models, I would say very little. Basically, the only very interesting feature is that you have a very light gravitino, and therefore what you get is that the next to light supersymmetric particle would decay to the standard model partner and gravitino, which means that we will have, for example, a lot of signatures with photons plus missing energy, which are a very distant signatures to look for in colliders, especially to kill backgrounds if you have photons there and missing energy. Of course, the signatures will depend a lot on the decay length, and the decay length depends a lot on the exact gravitino mass and on the exact mass of the next to light supersymmetric particle, say the Gaussino or the Higgsino. And there are three options that the NLSP decays promptly. and then you will have two hard photons, or you know, very energetic Higgs and Cs will can decay into Bs or quarks or generically plus missing T from the gravitino. Or you can have a macroscopic decay length within the detector, and then you will have nice things like displaced photons or a high ionizing track with a kink to a minimum ionizing track. And these are very nice features that you will see at colliders for these models. And then there are other options I will not talk about. So one interesting thing is that, you know, there is already some indirect information on supersymmetry from experiment. And for example, you know, if we consider the Higgs mass constraint from LEP, where I'm thinking about the large MA limit, so the upper bound on the Higgs mass that we have for supersymmetry from LEP, okay, which is about 114.6 GeV or so, so 115 GeV, it's very interesting that we can, you know, play bounds on tangent beta as a function of the heaviest stop mass and as a function of the splitting between the lightest stop and the heaviest stop. And so the regions allow here, depending which is the values for these stop masses, is going to be above these curves in the different cases. And I think this is very interesting because although I have, you know, once you put higher loop corrections, I have nuinos and charginos entering. So in this plot, I am assuming that Higgsinos and charginos are reasonably heavy not to change these. But we already have, if we would, for example, measure a light stop at the tevatron, okay, we'll have a curve in this area, which would tell us which are the lower bounds of tangent beta as a function of the heaviest stop mass. So this is already something that is pretty robust, I think, from LEP on lower bounds of tangent beta as a function of the stop sector. So what can we learn from the tevatron? We heard already that the tevatron will do great precision measurements for top quark and W mass. With two inverse femtobar, those are the numbers expected. LHC will most probably do somewhere around that or at most half of that error. But you see that in this MWMT plane, within the standard model, of course, these precision measurements are important to give us insight on the standard model favor Higgs mass and on what the supersymmetric mass could be. Well, the supersymmetric mass now is lying in this blue line in the MSSM. But you see, this is our present situation, okay? And this is the situation from the tevatron after two inverse femtobar. So we will really gain a lot from precision measurements at the tevatron. However, what else can the tevatron tell us to shape, you know, the next decade? And I think what is important is that we'll have stop and s-bottom sectors, searches in the stop and s-bottoms. And I think I will not go into the details, but the tevatron can nicely test stop and s-bottoms up to masses of the order of 200 GeV with four inverse femtobar of theta. And I think that's very important. Because we'll test electroweak baryogenesis. This is in SUGRAM type of scenarios. There are other interesting scenarios where you can have, for example, gauge-mediated scenarios where the stop comes to be the next to lightest standard model supersymmetric partner. And I will not go into the details, but there you take advantage of having a lot of extra photons and sheds and missing energy. And there the bounds on the stop, okay, as a function of luminosity can be basically of the order of 300 GeV in different channels. And for quarks, we can go up to 400 GeV. So the reason I put in these transparencies here is because I want to remind you that the tevatron is running now, and I think we should try to exploit what we can get from the tevatron vis-a-vis supersymmetry, and it's not, maybe has not been stressed enough in this conference. So for baryogenesis, what I was telling you, well, the right-hand stop is basically below 150 GeV. So this is the scenario. The left bound is, for this particular case, around 112 GeV. So the area that is allowed is all here. And what this means is that the run to reach for Higgs and stop will certainly probe baryogenesis at the electroweak at the electroweak scale. At the tevatron. Gauge-mediated, I think for charginos and geishinos, I think the tevatron can do very nice things looking for charginos and geishinos up to 200, 300 GeV, but I'm not going to go into that. So the other cute thing I think we have learned recently, or we have thought recently, that the Tevatron can do, and is related to relative corrections in the SUSY sector, is that one can probe tension beta the Tevatron from B2S to mu plus mu minus. In the standard model, this is a standard graph for B sub S to mu plus mu minus, and the standard model amplitude goes like this, VTS mu over MW. The branching ratio in the standard model is of the order of 4 × 10⁻⁹. This is far beyond the run one reach, that is of the order of 10⁻⁶. However, in the MSSM with two Higgs doublets, there is a Higgs mediated contribution, which would be what I'm writing here, okay? Well, then you have a Higgs coming up from this leg and giving you a lepton that actually can enhance the branching ratio enormously, three orders of magnitude, and can put this branching ratio at the reach of the Tevatron. This graph is the most simple one, where I'm not assuming any extra flavor structure in the MSSM. So this is minimal flavor violation, minimal flavor model, sorry. It's just induced from the CKM mass matrix. And what we see is the branching ratio now, we can basically have a coupling of the, so to say, wrong Higgs to the down sector, to the up Higgs to the down sector. And again, we pay, of course, a VTS here, okay? But this branching ratio, the most important thing is like goes like tangent beta. So this, where I'm putting a Higgs here, sorry, I should have had another a plus and minus. So this part would be like this part there, okay? So, but this goes like tangent beta to the 6 over the mass of the CPO-like Higgs square times some function of these parameters, which the only thing I want to stress here is that it's a non-decoupling effect. So if I do the supersymmetric particles heavier and heavier, unless I have a huge hierarchy among them, I'm not going to decouple this effect, because it's ratios of mu at over stop masses or Tarchino masses square. So this can give an enhancement of three orders of magnitude. And this tells us that if we look in this tangent beta MA plane, we can have contours of the maximum allowed value of this branching ratio, which are here. So if we, for example, at the Tevatron, around 2 has sensitivity of one single event for two inverse femtovaries of the order of 10⁻⁸. So if we would be with a branching ratio somewhere above, let's say, 10⁻⁷, which is very possible, we can really test, and if we will see a signature at the Tevatron, we will put a lower bound on tangent beta as a function of the mass of the CPO. And what I think is interesting is to propose, and I would think it is a good thing for this workshop to explore more, which is the reach of the Tevatron in the low, in the tangent beta CPO Higgs area, is to study the reach of this production channel that was discussed yesterday at length at the Tevatron, which is very important for large tangent beta, with the reach of these branching ratios in tangent beta MA plane for different SUSY breaking parameters, or for these different MSSM parameters. And we will see that will be a nice complementarity, I think, in these channels of the reach of the Tevatron. Okay, so the Higgs at 3 level. How are we doing with time? Okay. Good. So, very fast over the MSSM Higgs sector at 3 level, because I want to get you in CP violating effects for the Higgs at colliders. Let me just remind you a couple of things, since you all know through this, I think. In the MSSM, we originally have two CP even, one CPO and a char Higgs pair. And the things I want to remind you is that at 3 level, the coupling of the Higgses to the down and lepton sector are the same. So this is the ratio of the standard model to the MSSM coupling, for example, of little Higgs to DD bar and little Higgs to L plus or minus. It's this coefficient here, where sine alpha is the mixing angle that diagonalizes the Higgs mass matrix, and beta is the ratio of the two back expectation values. So this is one thing that appears at 3 level, and which actually, and the other interesting thing is that the couplings of the Higgses to the, for example, the light Higgs and the heavy Higgs to the Z are complementary, okay, and are, okay, and basically this means that when one is small, the other one is big, and this would be also extremely relevant for covering the MSSM parameter space at colliders, this feature. Okay. Okay. So the other important point, of course, is that at three level the Higgs mass would be excluded, but we have relativity corrections, and the relativity corrections are mainly due to loops of particles and their superpartners, and it's because of supersymmetry being broken, okay, by the incomplete cancellation of this due to Susie breaking, that we have important effects from top and stop loops because of the big Yukawa coupling, and for large tension beta also the bottom and s-bottom loops. So the main parameters that enter are, you know, this is the stop mass matrix, are the left and right soft Susie breaking parameters in the Higgs in the stop sector, and the mixing in the stop sector, where this mixing is proportional to the trilinear coupling and the value mu of the Higgs mass parameter. So this is the value of the Higgs mass in the large MA limit at one loop. And we already see at one loop the main effect. So this is the three-level value, and these are the contribution at one loop. And already at three level, we see the fact that there has an MT to the fourth enhancement. That's where the corrections are basically so big. There's an important dependence on this mixing of the between the left and right stop, and they have a logarithmic dependence on the stop mass and the stop masses. Of course, there have been a lot of work in two-loop log and non-log effects. And they are numerically very important, and when one does all that work, the upper limit on the Higgs mass turns out to be below 135 GeV for values of MS 1 GeV, and for the value of the top quark mass 175 GeV. If we change the value of the Susie breaking scale or the value of the top quark mass, we can of course shift this value up a bit. So well, this is just what I said before. So you see here, for example, how the Higgs, this is, it doesn't very nice. It's the light Higgs as a function of tension beta for different values of the mixing of the stop. But you can see these bands here show how much can the Higgs bus vary, okay, if you have tops going between 170 and 180 GeV. Okay, so it's a really important effect. And this effect just shows the value of the Higgs mass as a function of this mixing parameter, how it can really vary in different tension beta scenarios. Okay. So what is important is that for collider physics is that the behavior of the Higgs masses as a function, let's say, of the CP odd mass is especially the large tension beta behavior. Well, first of all, there is a sum rule that tells us that the heavy Higgs times cosine square beta minus alpha times the light Higgs mass times sine square beta minus alpha is equal to this maximum value, 135 GeV squared, that I showed you before, which means that when this one goes to 1, which happens for this area of parameter space, this guy is a standard model-like and has this value of the mass. When this goes to 1, which happens for large MA, then the little Higgs is the one that is a standard model-like, has standard model coupling to WNC, and the upper bound goes to this. And this is very important because if we put these two things together, we see that for large tension beta, this is the heavy Higgs, this is the light Higgs, we always have a Higgs mass below 135 GeV with a standard model coupling to the W and the Z. And this is really why we can cover all the MSSM parameter space so nicely at colliders. Okay, relativity corrections are really important, and there are two types of relativity corrections. There are those appearing through relativity corrections to the Higgs mass matrix, and this defines the mixing angle alpha, which enters in the couplings. And these are, a bit complicated effects, but what is important is that these relativity corrections depend on the sign of mu at and on the magnitude of at over ms, and one can understand well how this goes from nice analytical expressions. So this is one big correction that will change the couplings of the Higgs to fermions and also the coupling of the Higgs to vector bosons. And then there is another correction that is basically what we call the Susie vertex corrections to the bottom, to the Yukawa coupling, which modifies the effective Lagrangian, which couples the Higgs to fermions. And what I was saying, the effective Lagrangian, at three level we have one Higgs couples to the bottom and the other Higgs couples to the top. Well, at loop level, actually, the up Higgs, the one that couples to the top, couples to the bottom through its bottom loops, for example. And this would not be so important if it were not for the fact that these corrections can be very big because these corrections go like tension beta. So it changed the three-level relation of the boton with the boton-Yukawa coupling to the one-loop relation, so to say, where we have an this is a one-loop suppressed quantity, but this is an enhancement that for big values of tangent beta can make this of the same order of the three-level. And again, these corrections depends on the sign and on the of mu and gluino, and there's another graph mu at, and on the ratio of mu and gluino over this boton masses and the gluino masses. So the couplings to the big quarks are modified, and there is one point I really want to stress here, is that the Higgs boson couplings to big quarks can be modified in a very important way, and you see it here. There are two modifications. One is because now we have the effective value of alpha that I show you from the first relative correction, and the other one is because we can have very important corrections to this relation between the boton mass and the boton Yukawa coupling. As I said, it depends on the sign of values of these parameters, but what this does is it destroys the basic relation of the coupling of the little Higgs, for example, to bottoms with respect to the little Higgs to taus, that in the standard model and three-level is of the order of mb over m tau. This is very important because at low values of the Higgs mass, the Higgs decays 80% to bb bar and about 7-8% to tau tau. So if we are playing around now with these values, we basically change all the phenomenology. Okay, and we may be looking just for Higgs going into bs where they are not going into bs at all, or vice versa. And this is very important. There are certain conditions when these couplings can become really very small, and you can totally kill the coupling of the Higgs to bb bar and it still have a reasonable coupling of the Higgs to tau tau or other combinations. And so let me tell you what this does for phenomenology. Before that, let me say that for the char Higgs, you also have, I won't go through the details, but for the char Higgs to top bottom, and this is something I have been trying to let my colleagues at CDF and the Zero take seriously, but they have not done it so yet. So maybe this is a good opportunity. Try once more. So these corrections, okay, if this is of order one and say negative, okay, can be huge, okay? So these corrections are very important. And just to show you how important they can be, what did I do? Oh, I lost one? Okay, I will show you how important they can be in a second. So let me just show you some MSSN Higgs boson searches at hadron colliders and see how it's rushing me. I will. No, you're not? Okay, so I will just, I will concentrate on the on the standard model-like signatures, because yesterday was a lot said on the CPO-like signatures in this part, which means basically I will look at this process at the Tevatron, where this V is a W or a Z. And although it has been forgotten at Fermilab since a few months ago, I think we may still have something to say there, which is interesting. And then at LHC, I will basically talk about vector boson fusion, that is the big star in the low luminosity LHC, really the big star. And that's why one of the things that I have already said, but I will want to stress strongly in this workshop, I think Dieter Seppenfeld and Dave Rainwater somewhere here, and other people have done very nice contributions in this. Maybe one have to work even a bit more in detail this because it's a key component. So the weak boson fusion, especially with the Higgs going into taus, the gluon fusion, and then the associated production Higgs to TT bar where the Higgs goes to BB bar. Okay, so what I'm going to show you is some benchmark scenarios where you can see how these things can change in the way I was telling you before through relative corrections. For that, I will fix stop and S-bottom and Gaussianus, and I will show you variation with tangent beta and MA, and I will show you how much is the departure of the cross-section times branching ratio of the MSSM versus the standard model, and then I will show you which would this be as what can you cover in supersymmetry. So there are two scenarios I want to show you. One is the maximal MH-max scenario, which maximizes the value of the light Higgs and allows for conservative tangent beta exclusion bounds. Doesn't matter exactly which the numbers are, but let me just show you here. This is two cases where now in this scenario, the couplings of H to BB bar and H to tau tau are importantly enhanced due to relative corrections in the low MA, in the low MA region mainly, tangent beta about 5 or so. Which means is that if we look, for example, to the Higgs gluon fusion, where the Higgs goes to gamma-gamma, all this area here is strongly suppressed, because the branching ratio in BB bar and tau tau is strongly enhanced. The branching ratio to gamma-gamma is strongly suppressed, and which means in this scenario, the coverage with this channel is impossible. Okay? Instead, at the tevatron, for example, which in principle is much more moderate in reach, and of course at LHC with TT bar, Higgs, Higgs to BB bar, the cross-section times branching ratio is, in most of the area of parameter space, is highly enhanced. All this blue is above 1 with respect to the standard model. And so it is very likely that you can, you know, have a great coverage at the tevatron with this, while you will have a very bad coverage at LHC. And let me show you this. Okay. LHC prospects for neutral Higgs, Higgs searches. So this is, I think, interesting. It's the tangent beta MA plane, and this is what LHC can do. This is what LHC can do in the first 3 years with the Higgs to tau tau. Okay? So basically, the gray regions are the LEP cover, excluded area already. So you see, this is the decisive channel, just with 13 inverse femtobar. These are the channels that are TT bar Higgs, Higgs to BB bar, and glu-glu Higgs, Higgs to gamma-gamma. And OK, you see these are with 100 inverse femtobar. If you would look at these channels with the first 3 years, this is what you can do. So you can do basically very little. So this shows that, you know, this production, the Higgs to gamma-gamma, Higgs to BB bar, needs very high luminosity and is not very promising. So if we are in a scenario where this doesn't go well, it's not going to be very helpful. The alpha effective scenario is in a scenario where the Higgs to gamma-gamma, so for example, there is a basically, due to the relative corrections, a suppression on the Higgs to BB bar and the Higgs to tau tau. Okay? And as I said, these are the most important channels. We look at the tevatron and LHC mainly. So this suppression is what we see here. This is the tevatron for Higgs to BB bar, coupling times branching ratio. So there is a suppression here. So there is no way you can see things here, and you have a hard time in all this area here. But the point I want to show in this plot is that the suppression can be very different in the tau than in the bottom. I was saying at three level, the couplings have a ratio that is mb over m tau. When you go to relative correction, things can change a lot, and these channels, BB, H to BB bar and H to tau tau, at LHC and the tevatron, can be very nicely complementary. And this is what we see here, that, for example, even at LHC, okay, the tau tau channel here is suppressed, so we are not very, with 13 femtobar, we cannot do much. So there is a, now, when the tau Yukawa coupling is suppressed, the gamma channel is much better. And so the tau is suppressed, the gamma is enhanced. And then there is a complementarity then between vector boson fusion and the Higgs gamma gamma channels, just for 13 inverse femtobar at the LHC, okay? And the TT bar Higgs channel is only relevant with high luminosity. Okay. Well, this is about the char Higgs, and I will just make mention a point here. So far, the analysis done and that we have seen in this conference for CDF and D0 are even not considering, you know, are just doing leading order QCD coupling of char Higgs to top bottom, okay, in the branch ratio of top to bottom char Higgs. And so if we could do a better job even at the level of QCD corrections, for example, in the char Higgs tangent beta, the round one data will exclude this region. However, if we include SUSY corrections, again, that was exactly the same I was showing you before, we have this tangent beta enhanced correction of the coupling of the char Higgs to top and bottom. And depending which is the region of SUSY parameter space, okay, you can cover an important region or you can cover nothing. So it really depends a lot on what you are doing. Oh, I need a couple of minutes more. Okay. So let me just go into the last phase of my talk, that is CP violation in the Higgs sector. As I told you, after relative corrections, the CP violating effects are induced via third generation fermions and Gashino mass parameters. There are many possible relevant phases in the Higgs sector. The Guino phase, which is one if there is universality of Gashino masses. the trilinear coupling, the phase of mu and the phase of M1 half, the mixing in H1, H2. And due to U1 symmetries, U1R and U1 Peutz-Jeghikun symmetries, you can really redefine fields and absorb, in this case, two of these phases that we are putting in minimal. Usually you can redefine at least, at most two, okay? What this accounts to is that after refacing invariant combinations, if the imaginary part of this combination is different from zero, or the imaginary part of this combination is different from zero, then there will be very important CP violating effects present in the MSSM, and that's what I will try to show you in a moment. So now, instead of having the one CP odd and two CP even Higgses, will have three Higgses that will have mixed CP even and CP odd components. This is the mass matrix, and the important point is that now the CP odd mass is no longer a physical parameter, so one have to plot things between tangent beta as a function of tangent beta and the charging mass. And then we have, of course, as, besides the usual parameters, we'll have the phase, let's say, of IT and the phase of Engluino. Again, there are a couple of things. One have to do a lot of hard work, but not terrible, computing now the couplings of the different Higgses to the Ws and the Zs, and also the Yukawa couplings. The things to mention here is that, first of all, there are some rules that there is one coupling is always all couplings is given always as a function of two of them for the Higgses to the vector bosons. The other interesting thing is that this upper bound in the CP conserving case remains in the CP violating case, and this is very important because it came after a lot of hard work of two-loop analysis. And the other thing is that there is a sum rule, so there is the sum of all the Higgses to the vector boson coupling square is equal to 1. This is very important because this means that now all the Higgses are going to share couplings to the C, and this is going to make our life at colliders extremely difficult, or much more difficult. Well, for the Yukawa couplings, it's the same effect, but more complicated than when I told you before. So let me just go through the last three or four transparencies. CP violating Higgs bosons in the light of LEP, okay? Okay, so at LEP, the mechanism for searching for Higgses were the two outlined there. So let me now show you in this CPX scenario, where this is the lightest Higgs mass, and this is the heaviest Higgs mass, the second lightest Higgs mass, as a function of the phase of AT and AB. And the difference here is zero phase for the Gluino, 90 degree for the Gluino. And so you see that the masses can vary enormously. But most important, for example, for the lightest Higgs, okay, this is, I'm sorry, so bad here, this is the coupling to the Zs of the lightest Higgs. So there is an area here around 80, 90 degrees for this phase where basically this Higgs is not coupled at all to the Zs. And this is very interesting because this means that LEP could have missed a Higgs as light, for example, if we put somewhere here, this interesting case, if we have a Higgs that is 70 GeV, and a second to lightest Higgs that is 105 GeV, it's very well possible that LEP would have missed both. However, in this particular example, it's not the case, and this has triggered a lot of analysis at LEP, actually. MH1 is really too small to be seen, even if it is 70 GeV. The sum of these two masses could be at the reach of LEP, but the coupling, H1, H2Z, which is basically this coupling here, is not strong enough. And MH2 is at the edge of LEP, because the MH2 coupling we are looking is here. However, although it's at the edge of LEP, LEP reach is so interesting that really they can exclude this point. And to show you that better, let me show you what they have done for these scenarios. This is an OPAL plot where they have done, this included the point I show you, but it's much more extensive. So other cases require extra studies, and what is important is this: if H1 and H2 is kinematically allowed, and we are in a situation like the one I'm going to show you now, a point here, where the Higgs, lightest Higgs is 40 GeV, let's say, and the next to lightest is 105, okay? So where this guy H2 can decay into H1, well, then the present bounds at LEP may be highly challenged, and this is in reality what we are seeing here. Okay, so these are in a region where MH1, as a function of tangent beta, if we stand here for tangent beta, let's say 8.5 or so, we can have a Higgs that is 40 GeV and will not have seen, been seen at LEP, neither that nor anyone, any other one. Okay, we see that basically there are two interesting things here. Is that so there are different plots here, and I'm not going to go through all of them. But we see that when the Higgs, the second light of Higgs is below 130 GeV, then CP violation effects turn on. And what we see in this region here is that there is basically no band on the Higgs independent of value of tangent beta. So the fact that they have reduced couplings to the Higgs to the W and Z gauge bosons, and that there are extended regions where the second lightness can decay into H1, H2, means that there's no limit on the lightest Higgs that can be given independent of tangent beta. Of course, this is just an OPAL analysis, and maybe this can be improved by using, can be changed, okay, this conclusion, by using the results of the four-led experiment. But what this teaches is that maybe such decay chain can be seen at the tevatron, because this guy will have strong production with glue to the second lightest Higgs, that is a standard model light, will have a strong production here, and then will decay into H1. And this is something that has been, I think, thought by some people at the parton level some time ago. But this is a channel where, you know, the reach of the tevatron has not been exploited, and it's a nice possibility. A couple of other things I want to say is the complementarity between LEP and between tevatron and LHC. Two transparencies, I swear. So let me just make this point and I'm done. So I think that one thing I want to show you, this plot doesn't show it very well though, I'm sorry, the projection. They ask us to do that for the magazine, okay. Anyway, so the gray areas are just LEP exclusion, and the different areas here are tevatron with, all what I'm doing for the tevatron is presenting three sigma hints with five inverse Ventoval, that is what is real these days, okay? Because other things are not very real, I think, vis-a-vis luminosity. And then, so these are these lines, and the lines like all like these are the LHC lines, all combined. And what we see here is that depending on the phase that we are looking at, there are regions of parameter space that with all the power of so far, that all the analysis done so far for LHC, cannot really close these regions. So these are holes in the MSSM parameter space. And so we encourage the study of these channels in TTBAR H2 and WZH2 with the subsequent decay of H2 and H1, H1, basically using extra leptons on WZ, both at the tevatron and the LHC. Finally, I just want to show you, well, these are similar plots that what this shows is the same plot as before, but what I'm doing is I'm showing you what the tevatron can do, what the tevatron can do, what the LHC can do with 13 inverse femtobar, and then these two plots are Higgs into BB bar and Higgs into gamma gamma with 100 inverse femtobar at LHC. So you see here that there is a nice area that the tevatron can cover with Higgs to BB bar. Okay, so and we also see that the channel where the now is vector boson fusion at LHC with the Higgs going into tau tau is the crucial channel, even after 100 inverse femtobar, okay? You cannot close all with the other channels. You still need the tau tau, the Higgs, the vector boson fusion with Higgs to tau tau. Then finally, the last thing I want to show you is one case where the tevatron has great complementarity with LHC. So this is the same case. This is all what is, of course, covered is what the tevatron can do. This is LEP, okay? And this is tevatron with 5 inverse femtobar. These white areas are areas that are not going to be covered at LHC with Higgs into tau tau with 30 inverse femtobar. And you will need of the order of 100 inverse femtobar to cover these areas at the LHC. So this means that depending on the char Higgs mass and the tangent beta values, you can have big suppressions of H1 into tau tau. So the golden channel at LHC can be into trouble, and you will need high luminosity run at LHC to look at this scenario. Okay, so finalizing, there are also some nice things here, but okay. I would say that the tevatron studies for Higgs into V bar and the LHC studies for Higgs into tau tau are the two ways we have to direct test the Higgs mechanism, and they can be effectively very different by radiative corrections, and they can have really a very nice complementarity. So I think we shouldn't abandon our our project at the Tevatron of improving and doing our best on this channel. We should be very interested in it. The LHC channel where you produce TT bar Higgs and the Higgs going to BB bar generally needs a high luminosity option, maybe not 100, but for sure above 70 inverse femtobar. And the Higgs gamma-gamma channel may be actually quite less useful, and especially in regions with you have a CP violation, the Higgs gamma-gamma channel can be useless at all, completely. So the LHC discovery reach in the first years relies strongly on the vector boson fusion production with the Higgs into tau. So I think it will be useful to study these channels with more detailed detector simulations, and especially including challenging cases. So to finish, what I think is a bit my view on this, is by the end of this decade, the Tevatron we have measured MTMW to unprecedented accuracy. And this will constrain also nicely the Higgs mass. And I think if nature is kind or very kind, we may discover new SUSY particles or new particles at the Tevatron. If nature and the accelerators and the detectors are very kind and the physicists are quite smart, then maybe we can really learn something about electroweak symmetry breaking at the Tevatron. I think in the next decade, LHC is a sure window to new physics. If Higgs and SUSY are there, we will definitely find out. That less or more easily, depending how nature goes, how nature decides to go. There are exciting possibilities of extra dimensions, and that's Joe's talk. And then I didn't talk about the linear collider because that's Michael's talk. So I think that linear collider, of course, could be unique in precision physics, and most exciting, opening a window to planet-scale physics and having a connection to cosmology. Thank you.
That has been applied to full detector simulation now by both CMS and Atlas. That's available in the joint note. And the Vaughan Atlas group has also done this, all the other scenarios that you just discussed. Mark Schumacher has been joining those plots for about 4 months now.
Well, I have not seen the cases where the last transparency I show, where you have especially a very strong suppression of Higgs into tau. I have not seen that particular scenario. With that specific CPX scenarios, I have not seen that actually.
No CP violation scenarios,
That's the point I'm trying to make. The CP violate. No, that the smaller effective, yes. Sorry, and we missed on. That was not clear. No, what I'm saying is that the case where the Higgs to tau can be, is the golden channel and can be in trouble is when you switch on CP violation. That. Sorry if it didn't come through. That was the main point of my last transparency.
The phenomenological effect would behave exactly the same way as the small alpha effective scenario with regard to that channel.
I don't know. I don't particularly think so. I think that one has to do the analysis because the suppressions there. You have basically three Higgses which can be very close to each other in mass, and we can share the couplings to in the production. In the vector boson fusion production, okay? And on top of that, you have the Higgs to tau being diminished strongly, okay? So you have this case that is a bad case, and you have the case when the Higgs masses are very close to each other, and one has to be, can be the background of the other. And I'm sure this has not been addressed at Atlas and CMS, I mean, what I'm talking about. I'm sure of that. I mean, the one that you were alpha effective, yes, but the one I was talking about was with CP violation and these specific cases of Higgses being background to Higgses or sharing couplings has not been considered.
Okay, let's thank